Welcome to the 329th episode of the 4th and 24 podcast with Patrick Winograd. I'm your host, Randy Winograd. In this edition of the podcast, our topics are a review of Patrick's weekend predictions, a look at the final week of college football action, and week 13 of the NFL season, our weekly look at the NBA, and a recap of the past week in college basketball. So let's jump right in with a look back at Patrick's weekend predictions. In college football, Patrick went 2-2. In the NFL, Patrick went 0-4. In the NBA, Patrick went 1-3. And in NCAA basketball, Patrick went 3-1 with his weekend predictions. That means Patrick went a total of 6-10 this week, and it brings his overall total to 1,401 and 885. That's a 61.3% winning percentage. Patrick, your thoughts on your weekend predictions?
Well, obviously not a good week of predictions. I think the most notable thing was that all of the NFL games that were played on Thursday and Friday, the favorite did not win. And I picked three of those games, and of course, the favorite did not win in any of those games. And I had felt that Vegas had picked the right favorites. Oftentimes, I do pick underdogs, but this week, I did not feel like any of those teams were going to win, despite sometimes thinking that. But didn't think the Bears were going to go on the road and beat the Eagles. I thought it was a perfect bounce-back opportunity for the Eagles. They didn't take advantage of that. Cowboys-Chiefs was a really close game, so that's kind of to be expected there. And then the Packers and Lions, again, thought that the... I went back and forth on that one a little bit, so that one I'll say I thought about picking the Packers and didn't. So I guess I'm a little upset with that one, but not really. And then the Colts just had their opportunities at the end of the game with the Texans, a really close back-and-forth game, but the Texans ended up on top. So, again, all four were favorites, all four lost. Not thinking too much into it, because also if I had picked the Rams and Panthers, I would have picked the Rams, and the Rams lost to the Panthers. So doesn't really matter what game I would have picked. I would have ended up 0-4 probably this week. So that's a little bit disappointing, but it is what it is. And then in college football, had an interesting week. I think I also picked all favorites in college football too, now that I look at it. But no, actually, Texas was the favorite against Texas A&M. So Texas A&M was my underdog pick going on the road. They did not win. Georgia and Ohio State, of course, did win. Those were my two favorites that I picked that won. And then Vanderbilt won on the road and beat Tennessee. I just wasn't really convinced of either of those teams heading into that game, so I just picked the one that was at home, and it was wrong. Vanderbilt just demolished Tennessee in that game. So a middling week in college football is what that meant. Then in the NBA, like you said, I went 1-3. The Hawks, still shorthanded, beat the Cavaliers 130-123. The Magic beat the Pistons 112-109. I thought about picking the Magic because the Pistons were still on their winning streak as of the time that I recorded, or as of the time that I predicted the games. But then they actually lost a game to the Celtics before that. So I figured, actually, okay, great. Now they can just bounce back because they weren't going to win probably more than 15 in a row anyway. But because they lost, I actually felt extra confident about that game. And then they lost two in a row after their very, very, very long winning streak. But the Thunder beat the Suns. Got that one right. And then the Spurs beat the Nuggets, which was another one that I got wrong again. Shorthanded team against a team that people think is a lot better than them. So a little bit surprised in that game as well. In college basketball, I was the opposite of the other predictions. I lost one game on a buzzer beater, and every other team that I picked won by nine or more. St. Louis beat Santa Clara on that. Well, not really a buzzer beater, but a game-winning layup with about 5 or 6 seconds left in the game. And then Duke beat Arkansas 80-71, Michigan State beat North Carolina 74-58, and UConn beat Illinois 74-61, and I picked all of those right. So, of course, like I said, not the best week, but, you know, four favorites lost in the NFL. That's really what swung the week the opposite direction, so not actually that upset with it.
All right, well, we'll see how well Patrick does rebounding with next weekend's predictions when they're posted. Well, we'll see them when they're posted. On Thursday on our social media handles, 4th and 24, and obviously on next week's podcast, we'll see how he did. Let's turn our attention away from Patrick's predictions to a more in-depth look at college football action in the final week of the regular season.
Well, we talked about Vanderbilt beating Tennessee. That means that the Commodores end the season with, frankly, an existent playoff argument. I don't think it's a winning one, but they could make it, I guess, in theory. But they end the season at 10-2. A very good season for Vanderbilt, regardless of a playoff appearance or not. Tennessee, meanwhile, is one of like the 15 to 20 power programs in the country, actually, that never beat a team with a winning record this year. So still remain ranked, which is ridiculous to me, and I've said that all week, all year long, every week that they've been ranked, but they have no business being ranked, and here they still are. Guess I shouldn't have picked them either, but that's a different story. Then number 12, Miami, beat number 22, Pitt, 38-7. Miami was locked out of the ACC championship game due to some very weird tiebreakers that happen when your conferences are massive, and that means that, of course, their playoff hopes will hinge on where the playoff committee ranks them with their 10-2 record, with the win over Notre Dame, with pretty much better performances across the board against other common opponents with Notre Dame. Maybe they're relying on a BYU blowout, or sorry, a Texas Tech blowout against BYU. I don't know. We'll see if they can make it. Maybe they probably need Georgia and Texas Tech to win their games. And then I guess hope that Virginia wins and not Duke. But who knows? I have no idea if they're going to make it either way. I think they deserve it over Notre Dame for sure, because they won when they played each other. And that should mean something when the teams have the exact same record and one team is in a conference and played a harder schedule than the other team and ended up with the exact same record. But that's a different story. Then you have number 10, Alabama, who also probably shouldn't be ranked ahead of Miami. They are 10-2. They struggled again, this time against Auburn. 27-20, they escaped with the victory. But look, I mean, this team for a while now has just not looked the part of a top 10 team, of a playoff team. They've been struggling against everybody they've played, but they have another opportunity to beat the team they always beat. And if they beat Georgia again, obviously there's no discussion about if they make it or not, because A, they'd have two wins of over Georgia, and B, they'd be the SEC champion, so it wouldn't be a discussion. They would be in the playoff. But I don't necessarily think that the way this team has been playing, they really deserve that spot, but they'll probably get it anyway because of who they are and all the complaining they did last year when they were left out, rightfully so. Then you have number 8, Oklahoma, who was also at 10-2. They won 17-13. They also really haven't looked apart either, but you know what? They beat Alabama on the road, so they're one of the reasons why I'm saying Alabama doesn't look the part, so I guess they get credit for that, and also a good non-conference win against Michigan as well, which is something that Alabama doesn't have, because, of course, Alabama in the non-con lost to Florida State, who is very, very bad. But moving on from Oklahoma, obviously not playing in the SEC championship game, but definitely will be in the playoff. Oregon, same story. They won't be in the Big Ten championship, but they are also in the playoff. They beat Washington, 26-14 this week. A good win for them in a rivalry game. Of course, the Big Ten championship spot was technically on the line. It wasn't at the time of the game. They already knew they wouldn't be in it, because Ohio State beat number 15 Michigan 27-9. Just dominated every facet of the game, especially in the second half. They were just easily able to control the line of scrimmage against Michigan without having multiple first round picks and draftees on the defensive line like Michigan had last year. Clear talent discrepancy there in the trenches in favor of Ohio State, and they were able to ride that all the way to the win, as well as Julian saying, really, after a bad first series where he threw an interception, just completely settling in and dominating that game. So Ohio State moves on to the Big Ten championship to play Indiana. So 1-2 is the matchup we get, which is the matchup everybody wanted in the Big Ten championship. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the loser of that game. I don't know if margin plays a factor there. I don't know if no matter what, they stay 1-2, and if Indiana wins, the order flips. It'll be an interesting discussion. Maybe Indiana getting their first loss means they move behind Georgia or Texas Tech. I don't know, or both. Who knows? But the one thing we do know is that they won't be behind Texas A&M, probably, because A&M was already third, and they lost to Texas, 27-17. So Texas, of course, getting the win, and now they want to talk about making the playoffs. They're making the same argument that Alabama did last year, but that argument is not going to work, because they are 9-3, and there are plenty of 10-2 teams with better resumes that are going to be left out in the first place. Whether, you know, that's, in my opinion, should be Notre Dame, or even BYU, who's at number 11 right now, who's going to end up 11-2, even if with the loss, and a loss only in the conference championship game, to the same team that they already lost to, who's number 5 in the country. So that argument is just stupid. They have no chance. I don't get it. They're not going to make it. It's not worth it. But team that has another interesting argument is number 13, Utah. They, of course, beat Kansas 31-21. This was an important game because they still were technically in the race for the Big 12 championship game appearance and also for the playoff. They're definitely on the outside looking in, and the way they've played the last few weeks, probably won't even get a chance to get in. They'll probably get jumped by Vanderbilt this week, maybe by Texas too. Would not surprise me at all. But they haven't played that well for a few weeks. This game got gifted to them by Jalen Daniels, nearly doubling his interception total on the season in this game alone. He threw a red zone pick and a red zone pick six after throwing only four interceptions all year long. Also, the game was close at the time of both those picks, so Kansas kind of threw this game away. Utah just seized the opportunities they were given and ended up with the win. And then you have Georgia, who really only did any work in the second quarter, but that was all they needed to do. Started the game down 3-0 after the first quarter to Georgia Tech, but then scored 13 unanswered in the second, had a 13-3 lead into the second half. Georgia Tech could not get into the red zone, and when they got anywhere near it, they couldn't convert into touchdowns, just field goals. So Georgia ends up with a 16-9 win and clinches their spot in the SEC championship game against Alabama.
Let's now turn our attention away from college football and to the NFL with a look at Week 13 action.
Well, we talked about a lot of these games in predictions already, but starting with the Packers and the Lions, the Packers beat the Lions 31-24, moved them to 8-3-1 on the year, and moved the Lions to 7-5 as they are on the outside looking in when it comes to the playoff picture, which I think not a lot of people would have predicted coming into the year. But it is the truth, and I frankly don't think they have a great chance of making it at this point. They'd have to just go off against the Bears, pretty much. That's kind of their only avenue into the playoffs at this point. But the Lions, even though they are one spot out, they're behind the 49ers, who were 9-4 this year. So two full games behind a playoff spot with only four games left to play for the Niners and only... they're 1.5 games back now that I think about it. But... five games to play for the Lions, four for the Niners, and the Niners looking quite a lot better than the Lions, although the division matchups could mess that up for the Niners, but they've already played the Rams both times, so I think they just have one matchup with the Seahawks left and a few against the Cardinals. Actually, they only have one division game left, so probably against the Cardinals, maybe against the Seahawks, I kind of forget. But that means that, of course, the Lions on the outside looking in. The Packers, meanwhile, still behind in the division. That's because the Bears are now the number one overall seed in the NFC, at least. With their win over the Eagles, they move to 8-9-3 on the season. The Eagles move down to 8-4, still leading their division, but the Cowboys, of course, at 6-5-1, aren't too far behind and also have the win over the Eagles in the head-to-head. If they're able to get another win, that would be pretty important, but it's also worth noting that the Cowboys, by virtue of that tie, cannot end the year tied with the Eagles, because unless the Eagles get a tie later in the year, but I don't think that's going to happen. So we'll see what happens with the Cowboys later in the season. And of course, this weekend, the Cowboys played in a big game on Thanksgiving against the Chiefs. They won 31-28, had just enough offensive production to overcome Dak throwing an interception on the first drive and the Chiefs immediately scoring off of it. They were down 14-7 at the end of the first quarter, but ended up 17-14 at the half, and the Chiefs tried to come back in the second half in the fourth quarter, scored 14 points, but it wasn't enough to beat the Cowboys, who had built a big enough lead to protect, which means the Cowboys move above 500 for the first time, I think, this year with a 6-5-1 record, of course, going back to that tie against the Packers at the beginning of the year that has anchored their record in a very, very odd state all year long. Then you have the Bengals, who are 4-8, but they beat the Ravens 32-14. Joe Burrow returned and led them to a victory. It's really interesting because this whole division now looks a little bit different. They haven't really done much all season, but we kind of talked about it. If they could just win a few games, really the tipping point of the year was that if they could have just beaten the Jets and split with the Steelers, which they did split with the Steelers, but they couldn't beat the Jets. If they'd beaten the Jets right now, they'd be 5-7. And then all of a sudden, they'd be one game back of the Ravens, heading into two games against the Ravens. Of course, they did just beat the Ravens, but they're still two back because of the fact that they lost to the Jets. I mean, there's a bunch of other games they lost, of course, earlier in the season, but that was kind of the bigger one that people thought they actually had a chance of winning. But they split with the Steelers. They're one up on the Ravens, So they've had a lot of wins in the division. The issue is they just haven't gotten any wins outside of the division. They're actually 3-1 in the division and then 1-7 against teams not in the AFC North. And meanwhile, for the Ravens, this was really an opportunity to pretty much put this divisional race away if they had gotten this win. Moving to 7-5, that would put you a game ahead of a Steelers team that just has not looked good for a while now. But they'll have another opportunity to do that this weekend because they play against the Steelers, and the next weekend they play against the Bengals. So two really important games coming up for the Ravens. A win in both of those games pretty much clinches the division. I know it doesn't mathematically clinch it, but if they get to 8-6 with a win over the Steelers and a win over the Bengals, the Bengals are pretty much mathematically eliminated at that point. But the Steelers, I don't think, are going to get more wins in the rest of the season than the Ravens, especially if the Ravens take that first game from them. I expect that final game to not mean much by the time we get there, because the Steelers just haven't looked very good recently. But the Bengals getting that really important win, obviously they're not going to be in the AFC playoffs from a wild card spot, but they could still win that division. And so far, it's not looking too terrible now that they have Joe Burrow back, and they completely dominated this game against the Ravens on the road, because that means they have them at home later in the season. And speaking of the Steelers, they went up 7-0 on the Bills, or 7-3 on the Bills, excuse me, were up by that mark at half, and then they completely, I don't even want to say self-destructed, they just kept giving up points. Gave up 23 unanswered points in the second half. The Bills ended up walking away with a 26-7 victory on the road. Of course, Aaron Rodgers came back in this game, left the game for a minute because he re-injured himself, came back in the game, didn't do a whole lot. Just overall, this offense is just stuck in the mud, which I think is something that has been said about the Pittsburgh Steelers a lot for really the time since Ben Roethlisberger has retired. They really, and frankly, his last two or three years too, the same could be said. So not much offense going on in Pittsburgh, is kind of the same story, but this year the defense has kind of slipped even further to the point that you can't really see this team doing much in the playoffs, winning any games, if they even make it there at this point, looking like they're not going to even make it in the first place. But the Bills, meanwhile, desperately needed that win. Still with that win, they are 8-4 at the 7 seed in the AFC. So a scary 7 seed to face, but of course the Patriots keep on winning. They're 11-2 now, so it's looking like the Bills will be that team sitting in the 7 seed, and the Patriots are going to claim that 1 seed, because I don't know how you overcome the 11-2 head start that the Patriots have. They have a bye week next week. As long as they don't come out of that bye really flat, they're probably going to get the number one overall seed in the league. But that is not as important, of course, as the team who's in second place in the AFC, who almost suffered a loss that you wouldn't expect them to. But the Broncos came out with an overtime win against the Commanders, 27-26. They won in overtime. The Commanders went for two at the end of the game to try to win, and they did not get it. It was knocked down by Nick Bonito, and that meant that the Broncos walked away with a victory, moved to 10-2 on the year, which means they have the second-best record in the NFL and, of course, second in the AFC, only to the Patriots, leading their division still by two games over the Chargers and now by four over the Kansas City Chiefs, because the Chiefs lost again this weekend. Then you have the Seahawks. They are at 9-3. They won 26-0 against the Vikings. I don't even know if you can call this the Sam Darnold revenge game. He didn't need to do anything in this game because they just ate Max Brosmer alive. He could not get anything going in this game. A lot of people said it could not get worse than J.J. McCarthy, and they were somehow wrong. It was 100% worse this weekend than it had been the last few weeks. Brosmer just did not look good at all through three interceptions, the offense, maybe even four, actually. But I think, yeah, he did throw four because they turned it over and then the Seahawks fumbled after the interception. So technically didn't go down as a turnover, but it was another pick for Brosmer. But regardless, the Vikings have just looked terrible all year long, especially on the offensive end. And the Seahawks, they are doing Seahawks things. Their defense continues to dominate games. And importantly, they moved into a tie for the division lead that we'll get to in a second. But first, the Texans beat the Colts 20-16. The Texans now pulling within a game of that division, which is very important, of course, because they now, well, for now, they have the tiebreaker over the Colts because they beat them last week, but they also play each other the last week of the season, so that game will probably decide that division, considering the Texans are currently one game behind, and then could move into a tie with them where, of course, if the Texans won and had the same record, they'd be 2-0 against the Colts. If the Colts won, the Texans would have the worst record, so it wouldn't matter. But it's a very interesting situation to look at. Another interesting situation to look at is the NFC South, where the Buccaneers are now 7-5. They won 20-17 against the Cardinals. But I'm going to kind of skip over that game to talk about their other opponent in their division, the Carolina Panthers, who are now 7-6. They beat the Rams this weekend, 31-28. A turnover-heavy game by Matt Stafford, who hadn't thrown a pick in over 300 pass attempts, but one pick in the red zone off of Derek Brown's head, and then a pick six later in the game, and he also turned it over at the end of the game on a sack fumble where, had he just been sacked and gone down, the Rams would have probably kicked a field goal. It was rainy, so it wasn't a sure thing, but would have kicked a field goal to tie the game in the fourth quarter. You never know what could have happened. Instead, the Panthers ran out the clock on the next drive with one first down. The interesting thing is, of course, people had kind of said the Panthers, not really a legit team. You know, what can they do against a real team? They got a pretty good win this week. They also had a pretty good win when they beat the Packers a few weeks ago. Of course, the complicating factor in things is that the Bills and the Patriots really just ran them off the field. And they also had a loss to the Saints in that mix. So very, very strange up and down season for them. But the Panthers, they have an opportunity to really rebound against the Saints. They play them next week. If they can, or sorry, not next week, but the week after, they're on a bye next week. But if the Panthers can beat the Saints by a lot and really prove that that game was a total fluke, they'll have a lot of confidence going into the final three games of the season, which are against the Buccaneers, the Seahawks, and the Buccaneers again. So pretty important that they get that win against the Saints, because you do not want to be 7-7 heading into three games against bona fide playoff contenders, including one in your division. At that point, the Buccaneers would probably just need to split their games with the Panthers, and that would be the end of the Panthers season, because the Buccaneers do not play anybody good in between that. They only play the Saints, the Falcons, and the Dolphins. So really important game there for the Panthers, and really important for them to just prove that they can win against a true playoff contender, a team that was the one seed in the NFC heading into the week.
All right, that wraps up our look at the NFL for this week. Let's turn our attention to basketball, and we will start in the NBA with a quick recap of last weekend's action, starting, as always, in the Eastern Conference.
The Pistons are first in the East, of course, lost two games in a row last week, but then bounced back by winning two more over the weekend in a row, starting a new win streak perhaps, but doesn't matter regardless, they're 17-4. That's the second best record in the NBA, of course, only trailing the Thunder, who will always have the best record in the league. But they are three games ahead of the Knicks, the Heat, and the Raptors, who are all tied in second, third, and fourth. The Knicks have won four in a row to reclaim their two seed. The Heat are 14-7, and the Raptors are 14-7, of course. Raptors have lost two in a row, but they're still 8-2 in their last 10, so a good stretch of basketball for them. Then you have the Orlando Magic, who, of course, beat the Pistons over the weekend, have started to look like the team we thought they could be all year long, or all offseason long, I guess. They are 13-8 after winning three in a row and going 8-2 in their last 10. So they're just one game back of that pack that's 2-3-4. And they're only a little bit ahead, though, of the 6-7 seeds currently, who are the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Atlanta Hawks. Of course, the Hawks beat the Cavs last week in NBA Cup action, but the Cavs are 13-9, and so are the Hawks, both of them one half game back of the Magic and one ahead of the Boston Celtics, who are 11-9. So the Celtics playing some more respectable basketball, even though obviously they have a ton of injuries that have kind of derailed their season and really, you know, before it started, really, really lowered the expectations, especially the ceiling on this team. But they are still in eighth, and the Sixers, who are also dealing with a lot of injuries, are in ninth. Joel Embiid just came back, I think, last game or two games ago for the 76ers, and he had missed, I think, five or six games before that. But he's back playing for Philly again. Of course, this team has been very injury-prone. They have been winning despite the injuries. But we'll see what happens now that they have their MVP back and healthy. Maybe not 100%, but definitely healthy in some aspect of the word. Then you have the Bulls, who are 1.5 games back of the Sixers, had that hot start to the season. They've now lost four games in a row, 3-7 in their last 10. They're 9-11 on the season, but they're still a game ahead of the Milwaukee Bucks, who have been really bad recently. They've lost only won two of their last 10 games, so 2-8 in their last 10. They're 9-13 on the season, which does put them still barely behind the Bulls, as we just talked about, but closer to that kind of really bad spot that you don't want to be in, rather than in a secure playoff spot or even in a secure play-in spot where you'll have two opportunities guaranteed to make the playoffs. But the Hornets, they're behind the Bucks. They are 6-15. The Nets at 4-16 are right behind them. The Pacers at 4-17 are behind those two. And, of course, the Wizards are actually tied with the Pacers in last at 3-16. So that means that, of course, Wizards and the Pacers at the bottom of the East. Nothing new there. And in the West, nothing new there either. The Thunder are in first place at 20-1. They have won 12 games in a row. People have already started to talk about, can they break the Warriors' record? And I think it's a rightful conversation to have, considering the fact that they have played 21 games and they have lost one. If they win 12 in a row five more times, they will get to the record. So that's a pretty simple way to look at it. But yeah, I mean, actually four more times, I think they'd almost get there. But regardless, the Thunder are playing really, really good basketball, as always. And they got Jalen Williams back. So I should say Santa Clara Jalen Williams, not the Arkansas center Jalen Williams. They do have two Jalen Williams on that team. Doesn't convey well in podcast format, but conveys well in writing. Regardless, J-Dub is back. That means that team has gotten even better after already starting off the year, I think 18-1 before he came back. But that's a different topic, of course. The rest of the West is kind of the interesting bunch. The Lakers are now in second place. They are 8-2 in their last 10. They did lose to the Suns last night, but they're 15-5 on the year. 4.5 back of the Thunder for the first seed, but a game ahead of the Rockets and the Nuggets, who are tied for the third and fourth seeds at 13-5 and 14-6, respectively. Of course, the Rockets, 8-2 in their last 10, playing good basketball. The Nuggets, they're 6-4 in their last 10. They're staying afloat, but, you know, this is kind of what you expect from a more veteran team that probably at this point knows that they don't really care about the regular season. As long as they end up in the top four, they'll feel fine. Frankly, as long as they don't end up in the play-in, they'll feel pretty good about their season. And right now, they should feel pretty good as the season rolls on. But you have the Spurs in fifth, just a little bit behind those teams, a half game behind at 13-6. Beat the Nuggets over the weekend in the NBA Cup, as we talked about. The Timberwolves, who are 12-8, and the Suns, who are 13-9, are currently tied for that swing spot that becomes either a play-in game or a in the playoffs spot already. Timberwolves currently holding the sixth spot, Suns currently holding the seventh spot. But again, all those teams just three games away from the two seed in the Lakers. So it's a really, really packed bunch there in the West. And then the pack starts to deviate a little bit. The Warriors at 11 and 10, are 1.5 games back of the Timberwolves and the Suns, which means that they're kind of the separator between them and the rest of the teams who are not having great seasons. The Warriors just kind of having a middling season. But the Grizzlies at 9-12 and the Trailblazers at 8-12 are the teams that are rounding out the playoffs or the play-in bracket as we speak. The Grizzlies have won 3 in a row. Meanwhile, the Blazers are 3-7 in their last 10, but they're still in this play-in spot. The Jazz aren't far behind at 7-13, just one game back. The Mavericks are one game back of the Jazz. They're 7-15. And then the real bottom of the West, of course, includes the Sacramento Kings at 5-16. The Clippers, who are at 5-16, and the Pelicans, who are 3-18, all three of those teams losing three or more in a row. So not going too well for all those teams out West.
All right, let's now turn our attention away from the NBA and move to a look at the most significant action in college basketball last week.
Yep, college basketball, of course, had a big last week. It was Feast Week, which means there were a ton of tournaments. Luckily, we cut off, I guess you could say, the head of the snake, because we had Monday action already covered last week, which means that we can cut down a little bit on some of the MTE action. But we'll start with a lot of Players Era action. The number 17 team in the country, Tennessee, beat number 3, Houston, 76-73. Houston has been flirting with losing a game all season long. It was only right that eventually they did lose. They probably were a little bit tired coming off the double overtime game the night before against Syracuse, but it's also worth noting that they barely beat Auburn earlier in the season, which was pretty big game, and they, of course, barely escaped with that win. They did win, but they had flirted with it a little bit too much, played with fire, and all of a sudden they saw what happened. Tennessee able to out-clutch the Cougars, another good defensive team. Of course, defensive struggle in that game for sure is kind of the name of the game. But speaking of Auburn, number 7 Michigan went out, and they just beat number 21 Auburn down 102-72. Somehow, this was the closest game Michigan played at the Players' Era, which is ridiculous. But Michigan gets the win over a ranked team. We would see what happened with Auburn later in the week. I'll get to that in a second. But St. John's beat Baylor 96-81. That meant that they clinched a 1-1 record in the Players' Era because they lost to Iowa State the day before. And speaking of Iowa State, number 15 Cyclones beat Creighton 78-60. That clinched a 2-0 record. But of course, thanks to the format, they were one of the 5 2-0 teams, but there's only room for 4 in the top 4, which means that they didn't play in the third place game. They didn't play in the championship game. They did walk out of the Players Era Festival 3-0, though, and I think they will be happy about that regardless. They walked away with two really good wins and one pretty good win. And that's good enough for Iowa State. I mean, it's a big resume booster. You look at where the net has them initially. I think they're in the top 5, so they should be happy. They're 7th in the first net of the season, and a lot of that is off the back of what they were able to do, what they were able to put together in Feast Week. Of course, you know, would they have liked to have played maybe slightly better teams? Yes, but they can't really, you know, beggars can't be choosers is kind of my philosophy when it comes to the weird format that is the Players' Era tournament. But moving on from Players' Era action for a second, Cal beat number 18 UCLA 80-72. A big upset for the Golden Bears. Of course, UCLA off to pretty much the same start they were off to last season, where despite the fact that they entered the season on pretty good terms and really in good standing, where people thought they would be not necessarily a championship contender. I guess some people did think that. I definitely didn't think that. But, you know, they thought they'd be a respectable team, probably in the top half of the Big Ten, maybe just behind the tier of contenders that was kind of highlighted by Purdue, Illinois, and Michigan. They look like they might be behind the tier behind that at this point, maybe behind teams like Indiana. Obviously, Michigan State has kind of poked their head into the very top tier again. You know, they look behind that tier of teams as well. They just have not looked good at all this year. And, you know, maybe with the exception of that Arizona game, they played pretty close. That was probably the peak of their season so far. And saying the peak of your season was a loss to a former conference rival is probably not a good thing. But then you have number 23, NC State. They beat Boise State in the Maui Invitational. Of course, this was a rebound after they lost their first game in Maui. They moved on to the fifth place game. I'll talk about the fifth place game later. But number 25, Indiana, speaking of that second tier of the Big Ten, they beat Kansas State 86-69. Good win for the Hoosiers, continuing to cement themselves as a team that could trend up for the rest of the season. They are pretty high in the first net. They are 13th in the first net rankings of the season. So the Hoosiers doing a good job of staying in contention there in the Big Ten. Then you have number 7 Michigan, who beat number 12 Gonzaga 101-61 in the Players' Era Championship. Of course, a big deal for the Wolverines as they notched another win, not just a win, but a win by a huge, huge margin, and skyrocketed all the way to receiving, I think, 15 first-place votes this week. They're number 1 in the net. They're number 1 in KenPom. They are number 1 in Torvik by pretty large margins. They are my number 1 team in the country because, you can't say much about being number 1 in every metric except for the AP poll, which isn't a metric and is typically not indicative of how good teams are. But Michigan just hammered Gonzaga, who people had kind of crowned as the new best team based on how they played against Alabama earlier in the week. But, of course, that was not to be. Michigan won that title. And then in more consolation action that was kind of important, number 21 Auburn, they beat number 14 St. John's 85-74. So after Michigan had defeated Auburn and maybe people just thought, okay, maybe Auburn's not that good. Well, Auburn's here to prove that maybe Michigan's just that good. They beat St. John's by, of course, a double-digit margin. It was way closer than that throughout the game. St. John's actually led for a decent amount of the first half. Auburn kind of had to come back in that game, but competed throughout, kept it close. Tahad Pettiford took over and exploited the fact that St. John's guard play is not the level of a national title contender at all, which is one of the main issues that I had with that team heading into the year and why it was lower on them than the national consensus. But then you have Kansas. They beat number 17 Tennessee 81-76. in the third place game of the players era. Interestingly, that's another team that I was lower on the consensus, but now I've completely reversed course in that. They got third place in this event that had, I think, 9 top 25 teams, and they did all of that without Darren Peterson, which they're only going to get better throughout the year when he comes back. Although, interesting test comes up literally tonight because they are playing UConn. So we'll see what happens when they play UConn. We'll see if Peterson is available. If he is, maybe Kansas might win that game. If he's not, probably don't give them too much of a shot. They'll keep it close, but I don't think they're going to win that game. Although UConn also has some injury issues of its own. But then you have number 24, Vanderbilt, who beat Western Kentucky 83-78 in the battle for Atlantis. Of course, because the players' era was over, now we're moving on to the other events of the week. Number 4, Duke beat number 22, Arkansas 80-71, a good win for the Blue Devils. Although maybe haven't looked as dominant as you'd expect them to at the beginning of the season against some of the teams they've played, but it doesn't matter. I mean, they're really, really blowing out the bad teams that they're playing, and they're winning pretty comfortably against these other teams. You know, they might go through some shooting lulls in the middle of the game, but they do end up always on top and not normally by a last possession or two type of margin. It's typically by 3 or 4 possessions as it was in this game. Then number 9, BYU beat Miami 72-62 in the ESPN Events Invitational semifinals. Miami, a team that kind of had a very, very, very wide range of preseason projections, including me putting them at, I think, 35, and then KenPom had them at 40, but Torvik had them at like 70-something. So you could go a lot of different ways. They had no ranked votes either, so you could go a lot of different ways with how good Miami was heading into the season. I think they've proven they're probably somewhere right in between all of those rankings. They're probably a bubble team in the top 50, but not much higher than the top 50, the bottom of it. They're playing good basketball, though-ish. BYU, meanwhile, just continues to win games. That's really all you can ask of that team. But if you want to talk about another foe in their conference who has looked to kind of step up and maybe fill a void that was left by some other teams, TCU, they beat number 10 Florida 84-80. Of course, the highlight of TCU's point to that season was playing Michigan close at home, but they ended up coming out of the weekend at the Rady Children's Invitational as the champions because they also beat Wisconsin later in the week 74-63. So they beat a team that was picked to, I think, win the SEC at this point, maybe pick second or third, but at least the preseason number 3 team on a neutral court. And then they also beat a team that was ranked in the top 25 originally from the Big Ten. So TCU with 2 good results, proving that Michigan game that they played close wasn't a fluke. The New Orleans loss was definitely the fluke out of all of their games when you now look at their season from a larger sample size. But going back to other action, Michigan State beat North Carolina in the Fort Myers Invitational 74-58. Actually, Fort Myers tip-off because it wasn't an invitational. It wasn't a tournament. It was a set bracket. And Michigan State, again, just like last year, you kind of don't rate them high in metrics. You think that talent-wise, they're not necessarily all there. You don't see how the pieces fit together, but Tom Izzo does, and his team goes out, and they play, and they win games. And that has been the story for really the last 2 to 3 years, and Spartans are looking really good once again. Probably should be well within the top 10, if not the top 5 at this point. I think you could make the argument that 3 of the top 5 teams in the country might be Big Ten teams, with only Arizona and Duke kind of breaking that mold of Michigan, Michigan State, and Purdue. In whatever order you want to put all those 5 teams in. But Michigan State definitely has looked amazing to start the season, although they'll test it in conference play tonight against Iowa. So Iowa, a tough team to play, a tough style to get ready for as well. But continuing on with the battle for Atlantis, number 24, Vanderbilt beat VCU 89-74. VCU, probably a tournament caliber team. They're at least a bubble team. Played NC State close on the road earlier in the season. And of course, in this game, didn't necessarily play Vanderbilt too close, but that wasn't the only team that Vanderbilt was able to easily dispatch of this weekend. We'll get to that in a second. But number 5, UConn beat number 13, Illinois, 74-61 on a neutral court game at MSG, which isn't really a neutral court. There were some ref issues in this game, but it didn't matter. Illinois was going to lose. Maybe they could have lost by 5 or 6 points instead of 13. And this game is probably definitely closer than the final score indicated. But UConn with the win in that game. BYU beat Dayton to win the ESPN Events Invitational as well. So good win. Another good win for BYU, of course, just 1 loss on the season. But, of course, that loss coming against UConn. But finally, to end the week, we had number 24 Vanderbilt beating St. Mary's 96-71 in the Battle for Atlantis championship game. Vanderbilt just ran through this tournament despite the and their margin of victory grew in every single game, despite the fact that they played a better team in every game. People have not talked about this team. For me, they were in my preseason top 20, and I thought, you know, people, I guess, would say that was way away from the consensus. I think I had them pretty high up there. Yeah, I had them at 22, and then for the last few weeks, they've been steadily moving up for me into the top 20 and beyond. They're still being slept on by anything that's not a computer, but computers really like this team. Vanderbilt is number 4 in the net now, and I believe they're top 5 in KenPom as well. Or they're 10th in KenPom, 4th in the net. So that indicates they're a top 10 team, despite the fact that the AP poll has not caught up to that perception whatsoever. But it's interesting because, of course, you typically think the metric, the teams that the metrics like are the bigger market, not the bigger market, but the bigger brands, the Dukes, the Kansas of the world, with a lot of talent. But Vanderbilt had a lot of talent people didn't realize. And also, they have just been beating teams by heavy enough margins that regardless of what talent level they have, even a computer with talent rankings baked in from the preseason can't deny the fact that this team is looking really, really good. Frankly, one of the main contenders in the SEC at this point in the season.
All right. Well, that wraps this edition of the 4th and 24 podcast. Please be sure to check out our next podcast, which will be on Tuesday, December 9th, where we will once again talk about Patrick's weekend predictions, review conference championship game weekend, and do an initial preview of the college football playoff, review week 14 in the NFL, and have our weekly look at the NBA and college basketball action. In the meantime, please be sure to check out Patrick's picks for next weekend's games, which, as we mentioned, will be posted as always on Thursday, and his College Hoops Bracketology. That content is on our social media handles at 4thand24. That's the number 4, THAND, plus the number 24. Thank you for listening.